Welcome to Joiners, the podcast with Tim and Danny, where each week we explore the world of hospitality by chatting with its most colorful characters.
What's going on, Tim?
Hey, Danny.
You know what? I'm realizing that we haven't really broken the news officially.
What news is that?
That you are going to be a father.
I'm on the fast track to becoming a dad. That's true.
And
which is to say that Shannon is pregnant. It is my wife and I are having a child.
Yeah, congratulations. Very cool.
Thank you. Yep. Baby coming in September. Allegedly. Yeah.
And you know what? It's gotten me thinking about legacy. And we were talking this morning and it was pretty funny, but you had a funny thing that you mentioned about
about Arthur and baby Tierney taking over the pod someday.
Yeah.
I think that could happen. Oh, you know, man. What's interesting is that if we didn't have a kid, Shannon and I didn't have a kid, that's the end of the Tierneys. I have no cousins with kids that bear the Tierney
name.
That
is so wild.
It's pretty weird when you think about like a lot of pressure evolution and like the generations upon generations of Tierneys.
Whoa.
Coming over from Ireland, Ellis Island,
wow.
Doing all the grunt work, making a name for themselves in this beautiful melting pot we call America, and it all could have ended.
Wow. Good thing
a lot
it's
of pressure.
Not. We can't deprive the world of the Tierneys.
Yeah, I really don't think about my legacy, do you?
No.
I do think about having like 100 recorded conversations with people.
Yeah, I think there's like a cool like archival document or, you know.
NASA reached out to maybe broadcast some of this in space.
Yeah, to see.
We got Earth's best and brightest.
Yeah, this is the one podcast they're going to broadcast out.
Yeah.
The aliens are like,
what the hell is Culver's?
But we know we need to get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting to think about, you know, what the kids will be doing. It'd be so funny to imagine that.
Dude, everything's going to be so automated. They're not going to have jobs other than like serving robots or something.
Sitting in a chair and being entertained.
Idiocracy style.
Yeah.
Soylent Green.
But yeah, Tim bringing up the notion of legacy was very relevant for this week's guest. We're positively giddy over here. We've got Danny Wirtz.
Danny hasn't slept in weeks.
Yeah, I mean, another big get.
Yeah,
and
we're excited to have Danny in.
Yeah, and Tim's got some stats for you.
Yeah, let me just explain. People are like, well, this guy, he owns the Blackhawks. How does this relate to hospitality? Well, let me tell you. This guy serves 2.5 million guests a year with the help of over 4,000 employees. And they all help to serve 3.4 million beverages a year and more than 2 million food items, over half of which are chicken tenders.
Which is so crazy to imagine. Weird. Yeah, 1.2 million chicken tenders ordered.
Yeah.
Which is not just barely half. It's significantly more than half.
I don't know that I've ever had chicken tenders at a Blackhawks game.
I guess I haven't either, but maybe that's like what every kid's getting.
It could be.
That's wild.
Yeah.
But yeah, this doesn't even do Danny Wirtz justice. I mean, certainly impressive stats for United Center. But
yeah, he runs the family business now. He's Rocky Wirtz's son, who passed away last year, so he took over the business. But yeah, it's Blackhawks, you know, one of the original teams. It's been in the family forever. And you know, they also own alcohol distribution, which we talked about, which was kind of interesting for me to learn about. I think Danny knew some of that. Our Danny Shapiro knew some of that.
Yeah, Danny,
it does
of
get
course
a little confusing.
Yeah, Danny Wirtz knew a lot about it.
Yeah, but we won't keep you waiting any longer. So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation
with Danny Wirtz.
This episode of Joiners is brought to you by Branca USA, sharing Italy's taste with the world sustainably and respectfully. Fratelli Branca.
Welcome to the studio, Danny.
First time we've had another Danny, I think.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to have to
it's gonna be confusing.
Specify here.
Yeah, we got close with Donnie, but this is a dead on. So what's
well, it's
up?
Great to be here. Longtime listener, and just appreciate you guys having me over here on a Friday.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
So we have one confirmed listener. That's good to know.
All right. So, Danny, you're born and raised in Chicago.
Yep. Actually, the northern suburbs.
Okay.
I know some people like to be real technical about that, but I did grow up in Winnetka, Illinois.
Okay.
On the North Shore. But yeah. And
do you guys live there, your family?
No, we are now and sort of stubbornly proud Chicagoans. We lived in the Ukrainian village for 15 years now, so we're putting our roots there and real committed to the neighborhood and living in the city.
Awesome. Did you ever consider moving north with them?
No. and actually, most of the pressure that comes from family and friends up there only makes us want to entrench further into our life down here. But it's we just naturally urban folks at this point. Living in New York, London, we kind of got acclimated to living in an urban environment. And so, and we love our neighborhood. We love our neighbors. You know, I operate kind of within a few mile radius of the United Center and
It's pretty convenient.
The kids' school and everything. So it does become the kind of center of our universe.
Yeah. And
so.
You've always been a pretty big supporter of hospitality. Like you love to frequent different bars. And
well, yeah. And I don't know what I would do if I lived in a place that didn't have all that hospitality around us. So I love the fact that we have, you know, great tried and true neighborhood spots. We have lots of new things that always kind of come through that part of town, and we're so accessible to some of the great things in Chicago. So
and you're close to the United Center.
Yes, that really does help the post-game commute.
Do you have an office? I assume you have an office there. Do you have like a day-to-day office that you work out of?
I actually work out of the United Center.
Okay.
Most of the time we have a kind of a family headquarter office on Lakeshore Drive that's been our family for a long time, and then our beverage distribution facilities out in Cicero. So that those are all the kind of places that I could work, but United Center now is becoming the spot where I hang my hat.
Yeah.
And growing up, did you know you always wanted to be in the Wirtz family business?
You know, I think a little bit. Like, I think I had a lot of pride. And of course, as a kid, you know, the shiniest and sexiest thing being the Blackhawks definitely was something that I was interested in being part of. But at a certain point, I also wanted to do my own thing. So that's what kind of took me to New York and London and kind of on a different path that ultimately did lead me back home to the family business. And then exploring some of our other businesses like beverage distribution and realizing those were just as exciting and just as vibrant and dynamic as professional sports was kind of cool to see kind of the breadth of what our family's involved with.
I did a little bit of research, and I know that you're a state champion hockey player. Was there a time where you're like, that's it, I'm going straight to the pros?
No, that was the peak. That was the I went out on top. We won our state championship my senior year of high school, which was the first championship in the United Center.
Wow.
The building had just opened up, and it was the first kind of time they held a state championship there. And so we won, and then from there I hung up the pads.
And you got into the music world from there. Is that where your interests lied outside of
sports? Yeah, I think, you know, hockey? Sort of, I guess a kid of the 90s, you know, the music was such a big deal and things were happening in Chicago. And as I went to school in Boston and then ultimately moved to New York, my interest was actually working in the music industry. And that's kind of where I was interning wherever I could. I was networking with folks in the industry, obviously consuming as much music as possible. And that was pretty much the path. And that was kind of the direction I was going. Not really thinking about the family business at that point, but
is that how you met your wife?
Yeah, we actually worked at the same company, which was is a company called Cornerstone. They're sort of an agency that now are sort of more brand than probably music, but kind of one of those companies that was in the early 2000s that was marrying music and promotion of music on radio and digital with brands. And you know, thinking about that time, it's, you know, kind of pre-social media, early Napster. So we were in the middle of watching essentially the music industry collapse in one sense and then rebuild itself in other ways. So it was pretty crazy.
What was the consensus at that time? Were people, I mean, was everyone like, fuck Napster? Or was it just panic?
Well, I think the industry was panicked. You know, their product was being essentially
pirated
and given away for free. If you were in the business of selling, you know, units of music, you know, just completely turned it upside down.
Yeah, this is pre-iTunes, because iTunes was like a big shift.
Yeah, and that started when we were, you know, sort of, that was kind of early days. And it was interesting because the company I worked for, you know, this is when bands would not affiliate with a consumer brand. Or, you know, of course, being a sellout was like the worst thing that could possibly happen.
It's
so weird now where actually you're pitching brands to work. It's the other way around. So we were sort of the intermediary to make sure that whatever brand wanted to work with an artist, we helped make sure that everything was cool, you know, and that it was done properly and done with credibility and stuff like that. So whether it was like, you know, putting jeans on bands at South by Southwest, or whether it was putting, you know, new products. We were launching the Microsoft Xbox at the time and putting it backstage at festivals and things. So it was funny, like those two worlds coming together. So that was probably the start of a whole new era of the music industry, where kind of consumer brands entered the music space in as like cautious of a way as possible. But obviously that's commonplace now.
How do you think those experiences, like in New York and London and in the music industry, shape what you do today?
Well, I think, you know, I was always kind of in an agency role. So I think when you operate in sort of a service model, like, I mean, there's always clients, you're always sort of operating on behalf of others, you sort of, you naturally have a more hospitable approach to things, a client mindset, a service mindset to sort of, you know, take the challenge and try to deliver for the folks. So that sort of built up a little bit of that. I think really understanding brands and how things get launched within culture is really important. And of course, as I got in the beverage business and starting to see how, whether it was an emerging spirit brand or a craft beer brand, you know, got launched, oftentimes, you know, sort of cultural influence becomes a big part of that. Obviously, working in professional sports, we're talking a lot about that now in terms of how sports, teams, players are all now part of much broader cultural conversations, and how brands are becoming more culturally relevant in the world. So for us at the Blackhawks, it's on top of our just core hockey fans. We have to find ways to expose the sport and expose our brand to more groups. So, you know, culture becomes a really big piece of that. So I do think all that work in music has a lot of tentacles into the many things that I have to do these days.
Yeah.
So you're fourth generation owner, is that right?
Yep. So it was my great grandfather kind of started it all, you know, acquiring the Chicago Stadium right out of the Depression, started in real estate, didn't have a lot of money to start, just was very good about reorganizing real estate, and kind of got into sports and entertainment through real estate. He needed tenants, he needed sort of content to fill those buildings, and lo and behold, it turned into what it is today, which is obviously sports is much different and people enter sports and own sports teams. But it wasn't, you know, back then, you know, sports was not what it is today. It was a little bit of a shady world of.
Yeah. It wasn't a business. It was like,
no.
I think you look at those athletes. I always look at like old baseball players. I'm like, what? Babe Ruth? He's like 5'6", and I don't think he can make it around the bases.
Yeah. The athleticism may not have been there. I feel everyone was smoking. It was different, and it was still entertaining. And, you know, and you look at the crowds and people came out, but it just, the money, the sponsorship, it's not what it is today. And so, it is funny being kind of like one of those original ownership families in today's sports world where, you know, I sit across the table at the Board of Governors of the NHL, and there's these titans of other industries that have made billions in other industries that have now entered the sports world, and they're kids again. They're so excited to own their team, and I'm really excited about having folks like that around the table. But I'm like, geez, we're just, you know, we've just been around here for a long time. I feel like the old school guy around this table.
But, yeah, there's something to be said for that, though. I mean, I know the Mavericks was a big one. When did that kind of become a thing, when you had like tech billionaires coming in and buying teams?
Yeah, I guess
probably. I think he paid like $250 million or something.
Oh, yeah, I mean, in today's terms, everyone got a bargain, even just 10 years ago. But look, I mean, I think there's only so many. Anytime there's scarcity of something, you know, values are worth a lot. And especially people that can sort of buy anything anywhere at any time, you know, the most coveted things will be things that no one else can get. And so when one of those teams goes for sale, that's, you know, that becomes the hottest thing for someone to want to buy, especially for a class of folks that, you know, really money's no object. So again, a world that I still don't relate to. Again, this is our original family heirloom in many ways that we continue to steward along here. But you know, God bless them, because the values have gone up considerably.
Do you find it weird or odd to reflect on your position in all of this?
Yeah,
like just as a member of this, you know, storied family. And
it is. I mean, look, it's. I feel very privileged to have grown up how I did and be part of this family. But I think, you know, I still consider myself just a dude in the Ukrainian village. I'm not like it. So I do feel like I straddle multiple worlds.
Yeah.
But with that comes a lot of responsibility, a lot of great opportunity, a lot of great influence to do good and to contribute to Chicago, contribute to the community. So, I'm really very lucky.
Yeah. You've done a great job with it. We went to, a Hawks game for my wife's birthday a couple months ago. It's a great experience to go. When did you take control, I guess?
Well, in 2020
became CEO. Okay.
Yeah. It was an interim president role that was, I think, a month into COVID.
Oh,
so
wow.
My joke is like, I don't know if this was like punishment for my dad to be like, you know, just run this team. There's no revenue coming through the door. And, you know, we have no idea when fans will come back and to watch our product and spend money with us. So
just testing your grit.
Yeah. So I lived in Edmonton for a month in the bubble with the team. And cool. So it was I don't want to ever go back to that. But that was the start of this crash
course. Did
your
family come out? Or were you?
No,
like,
nobody was allowed to.
So everybody was isolated, allowed to leave. Your wife in Edmonton?
What's that?
Everybody was in like isolation.
So so the NHL went to two bubbles, one in Toronto and one in Edmonton. I won't comment on which one was nicer, but and they held kind of a play-in end of season and play-in playoffs, you know, situation. They ultimately awarded the Stanley Cup.
This.
I know it does feel like, was that real?
Yeah.
Was it literally a dream or a bubble?
What was day to day like there?
Oh my gosh!
Do you get to know the players on another level?
We were kind of all, you know, because we were all isolated together, there's sort of like a meal room becomes your central place. You're walking through this sort of fenced in, like there's like three hotels all within a fence line that surrounded the arena. And the only people there were people who worked for the team, which is limited staff, and then players. So every person you saw would be like at a college campus where every person you see is a professional hockey player. Hmm. So it was very surreal. You know, I went a little crazy after a couple of weeks. It was.
Did anyone try to escape?
No, but there was some rumors about either someone coming in or leaving in a way where, you know, they were pretty serious about, you know, the checks and daily testing and everything like that. So.
So the players weren't sending for. You know,
what are you going to say, Danny? What are you going to say
here? Conjugal visits.
Well, look. What happens in the bubble stays. There's nothing bad. Just, I mean, I think just
that's
everyone
just the one thing I would imagine. Just people being like lonely.
Oh, the socialization was terrible, and we were we kind of made it in this play-in round, and then we lost in the next round. So we were out relatively early. But for other teams, I think they had.
Were you hoping for that?
I mean, I have to tell you. Well, I wanted the team to win. I was like, well, the consolation, I get to go home. So it wasn't so bad when we were finally eliminated. And I got. You know, liberated back to Chicago, but it was a wild experience.
So when you took over, so when things open up and you start to make some changes at the United Center, were there things that you'd wanted to do for a long time that maybe you couldn't because you weren't in charge, or what was it like? How did you? What were the first things you wanted to?
Yeah, well, implement? I mean, we had to rebuild a lot of the front office. So the first task was hiring our new president of business operations, Jamie Faulkner. And when she came in, you know, she came in with a really extensive hospitality background. You know, working for Compass Group and Levy, mm-hmm. and really operating in and out of a lot of buildings and working with a lot of different teams. So, you know, getting to know her and how she saw the world really kind of got me excited about what's possible. Both in the Blackhawk experience and some of the arena things we want to do. We always have been known for, I think, a really good game presentation. So there was nothing I was like, stop what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Let's change it. But by all means, I sort of knew that once we came back, we had to keep raising the bar because I think just the competition to, at that point, especially getting people back into these environments, you had to give them something more than just what was on the ice. And so I think our philosophy is very much, you know, sort of to entertain and to engage fans, regardless of what's happening on the ice and regardless of the performance of the team. So hopefully you leave the game and hopefully you left the game feeling great. And maybe you forgot about the outcome of the game, but you remembered what you ate, what you drank.
He definitely remembered the entertainment. Yeah. He told a story about it on the pod.
Well, that was a Bulls game. We got a red panda halftime show.
They were the best and probably the first of really bringing entertainment to the sports world.
Totally.
I remember growing up and even to this day. They always do it so well.
Was that born out of the Jordan era when it was just like you had to match? I mean, it was such a show during the game. You had to have the halftime show
I think so. And I think the NBA always was
pretty... Girls were like a big turning point.
This isn't about LA, Danny.
I know, but it seems like I'm watching winning time.
But the lovables were a huge piece of the brand. But
There's a photo of a young Tim Tierney grinning ear to ear in the middle of the lovables.
Yes.
Probably 8 years old.
And that set the course for his entire life.
It really did.
Formative.
Serious listeners of the pod have probably heard the original stock ad at least 85 times, 90 times. Danny?
Yeah, lots
Danny's
of times.
Smiling and nodding.
Yeah.
Well, we flipped it on its head this time. We took the original script and we turned it into a Mad Lib, and Danny picked the words, the product of which will be read right now. Here we go. I don't know why you're mic'd up for this. It's funny, though. This hot dog of Joiners is brought to you by Stock Manufacturing, makers of horny electronics. You jump over the pools in your farm, so I stop at your fisherman's hats. Stock has something for every printer. From sweaty messages to ditzy gin, they've got you covered. Choose from in-stock, ready-to-wear photos, or design the perfect custom mango for your shoe. For more information, visit StockMFGCo.com. Stock, creative workwear for the hospitality industry. That's pretty funny. I will note that Danny had made it very horny. He didn't know what we were doing, but I had to have him dial it back. And I feel like this is a more tame and presentable version.
Oh my gosh, just calm me out. Do you remember like those early experiences going to games, you know? And
yeah, I mean, the Chicago Stadium
how you had to behave and represent the family.
So the Chicago Stadium's really just a core memory for me. And anybody who's been to that, you know, growing up or spending time there, I think you can vividly remember what that stadium was like. And it's unlike anything. It's almost like I always equate it to, especially for people who haven't been, it's like essentially a giant dive bar. You know, it smelled of beer. It was really smoky. It was inaccessible from an 88. Like, it was all stairs. It was like, you know, hard surfaces. But it was amazing. It was intimate. It was loud. I mean, the whole thing kind of shook. So it was a really special place to grow up. And then to kind of, as a kid, like explore the bowels of the stadium and all the characters that kind of lived and worked there. But yeah, I mean, I was a little kid from Winnetka and khaki pants and a shirt and tie and sport coat. And I would sit in my seat and eat my popcorn. There still is a family kind of lounge called the Sonia Henny Room, named after the figure skater Sonia Henny. And that was sort of the adults' room to host, you know, friends, family, VIP, dignitaries, politicians, all that kind of stuff. And I grew up in that very adult world as the kid. You know, again, basically hanging out at a bar every, you know, game. But, you know, great memories there growing up. I got to see, you know, different eras of the Blackhawks over time. And, so the stadium became a real special place and was hard to say goodbye to it. But it's hard to believe the United Center is now 30 years old. So, you know, my kids are going to have their core memories of growing up at the United Center.
Were you aware that you were, like, in the public eye from a young age?
My parents, I think, raised us pretty low key. And I think generally speaking, our family tries to keep it pretty low key. But, you know, you definitely knew that. And, you know, you carry the sort of ownership tag. And at the time, whether it was different policies our family had or whatever, or a player trade or something, you sort of heard, you know, a few little jabs here and there. And I was actually thinking about it, like, gosh, if I had grown up in the era of social media, and let's say fans disliked my grandfather. Well, in that era, maybe you get a bad article written about you in the Tribune.
Yeah,
you'd be like getting death threats.
Or you would have to go to someone's face and tell them how much you hated them.
Yeah, you'd be inundated.
But if it was today, I mean, I don't know that I could leave the house because our family had some rough goes there growing up. But so I was actually shielded from most of it, and I was very fortunate.
That said, how many people are coming up to you with tips and trade offers nowadays?
A little bit of advice, but you know, one of the great things, and I'm not sort of naive to the fact there's probably plenty of people that have contrarian thoughts about how to run the team. There's nothing better than hearing most fans come up and just, they want to share how much the Blackhawks mean to them. Mm-hmm. So if you have a job where someone comes up and tells you that some of the best times of their life has been because of your work, some of the greatest memories they've had, you know, what a great night they're currently having, how much they love your brand or your team or your company. I mean, that's a really fulfilling job. So I'm very lucky to hear that often. And that's the stuff that kind of fuels the work, you know, because you just want to keep giving the fans these great experiences and great moments.
Nicely put. The what are the pregame spots, or what were the pregame spots around the stadium before, like when you were a kid? Like, I lived above the Ogden.
Yeah.
And when I think it's called the Barn now.
Now it's the Barn, like Hockey
Jerry
Barn.
Still owns it. But I lived above there, and it was like empty, unless there was a game at the United Center, and then it was packed.
Totally.
So like that, and like Billy Goats. What were some of the other spots? Like, where were you
of
going?
Of course, the Palace Grill.
Burned down.
You know, I don't want to say rest in peace, because we hope it will be resurrected.
It better come back. I had just gotten turned on to that place, and my wife and I were going like every weekend, and I had a meeting there one morning, and it was like boarded up. I'm like, well, shit. There's so, like, the news was out front.
It's such an institution, and it was literally the spot, you know, players, coaches, management would, you know, after morning practice at the stadium, would go over there. So it's always had a relationship with the Blackhawks and the stadium in United Center. You know, there was sort of Hawkeyes on Taylor Street, I remember. That was one.
Okay. Yeah.
Tofano's was another. So, I mean, none of these are really close to the United Center or the stadium, but clearly that was.
If you're coming from the south, it's on the way.
Exactly. Yeah,
I was always coming from the north.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. The original Twisted Spoke, I remember, like, yep, you know, driving, yep, getting off the expressway with my dad in the car and seeing like the skeleton, which at the time was really scary and
my
spooky.
My kids actually just noticed it the other day. Like, yeah. Skeleton.
Yeah. So, yeah, those were kind of like the spots. But over time, obviously, with the expansion of, and then, oh, I have to mention Chelly's Chili Bar. So Chris Chelios opening up his bar and restaurant just a little bit down from the Palace Grill. So that was like one of the first additional restaurants on Madison at the time. So yeah, there wasn't much, but I think it's really great to see so much growth kind of all directions of the United Center these days, and the neighborhood's developing.
And now once you're in the building, there's so much to eat,
gosh, yeah.
which is true of all Chicago sports. Like, I go there to eat too.
It really, and we think it's, I think it's like the second most important thing in the fan experience, you know, it's like the team performance, and then it's like the food. Like, it's really like,
yeah, it's Chicago. We care about sports and food.
We really, and obviously, you know, we sell a lot of the core items, and then bringing in more specialty things and bringing in partners, you know, whether it's Stephanie Eisert and her tacos, or whether it's, you know, chicken, but done by honey butter. And like, it's just like, adding those partners, those brands, and those kind of differentiators has been a really nice, you know, it's been nice. I think our fans really, really like that variety. And for fans that are there every game, it's nice to have a little bit more than just those core items. So
yeah, it's a shortcut for tourists. They can come in and taste authentic Chicago things while they're there.
Absolutely. So yeah, food and beverage, really big priority. We've come a long way, and I think we hope to do more and more interesting things, and figuring out how to do it. It's easier said than done. I mean, I can fantasize about my favorite dishes in Chicago, but you have to do it for the masses,
for the volume,
you know, in the thousands, you know, which is just amazing to watch and witness with the team at Levy.
Are you going to every game in season?
I am. Yes.
Wow. Whole game.
Yeah, I mean, I might sneak out a little early, depending on, and I live very close, but I still like to leave a little early just to beat traffic. But no, it's fun to be there. You know, you get this tremendous adrenaline rush. I mean, it is, you know, in the spirit of hospitality, you know, you're hosting, you know, 20,000 people for an event, and you want them to have a great time. And so any opportunity you have to sort of interact with fans, see how the night goes.
So you're like making rounds kind of throughout the stadium.
Yeah, I try to,
on who's there.
Definitely. I mean, you know, unfortunately, I don't get a chance just to sit and watch the game. Actually, the last game I probably sat and watched the longest of any game this season. But the best parts of a game night are just interacting with fans.
Yeah.
And just making the rounds, and folks come up and say hi, or I'll check on, you know, having a good time, or, you know, just like you do at a restaurant. Just picture it. And that was very much my dad's philosophy. And he sort of changed the mold of the owner kind of hiding behind glass to sort of sit out with the fans, because he always equated it to, it's like if you owned a restaurant and you sat in the back room.
Yeah,
no, right. You got to get out in front of house. You got to talk to your customers, make sure they're having a good meal. And I think that was such a great example for me to watch him operate in that kind of space.
It makes sense. Everything's probably on point in the owner's box. You got to get the...
Yeah, no, everything's going to be fine.
You got the other 20,000
yeah, exactly.
people are
doing. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to be fed well, drink well, and yeah, exactly.
What's your relationship like with the team, with like the players?
With the players?
Yeah.
Do
you get a lot of FaceTime? Do you want a lot of FaceTime?
No, I mean, I think every owner's a little different as to how much they want to, you know, hang around the players. I think it's important to give them their space to operate, make sure they have everything they need, by all means. I, on one hand, want to be accessible, but I tend to give them the space they need to do what they need to do, and work through the management team to make sure the resources are there, that they're well taken care of, and they can be their best.
In the process of bringing on someone like a Connor Bedard,
yeah.
Are you like wining and dining the parents, the family? Like, how does that all work?
Well, he's too young to be wined, Danny.
yeah, well, it's not
the parents says that and the family.
You know, I think a lot of it, especially drafted players or players where it's not about necessarily recruiting them, but right. more just, we just want players and then their families to feel like they're now part of a new family. And I think I think about the last era of the Blackhawks, whether it was the Kane family, the Seabrook family, all these folks, whether it was the players' parents, siblings, and then ultimately when they had families and they had kids, you know, you really becomes very familial. So we have a lot of young players who, you know, whether it's Connor and his family, or it's been great at the end of the season, we've had a couple rookies join the team, and these are their first games. Their families are there, their extended families, their friends are there. And we want them to have just the best time. We want them to be taken care of, be able to watch their son play their first professional game. So we do a lot to make sure they feel really comfortable and they feel, you know, part of this new world that they're in. And, you know, for many, it's pretty life-changing in terms of the stratosphere in which these kids operate in.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine that whole process mm-hmm. and what it must be like.
Totally.
Getting called up. It's never too late. I think Danny's going for the PGA
Tour. Yeah, we have though. A player. I mean, so the fun thing is like when college players leave college. So Frank Nazar, who just signed with us, you know, his team was eliminated in the Final Four, the Frozen Four. He's a student at Michigan. So he's a student, like presumably goes back to his dorm room in the dining hall. And, you know, within like 3 days, he's signing a contract, and within 4 days, he's now on the ice playing for the Blackhawks. And I can't imagine that jump.
Crazy.
You know, wow. Within a matter of a short period of time from being a college student, you know, playing college hockey and living a, you know, just a college life to being now a professional athlete that fast.
He's probably emailing all those professors like, not going to hand that work in.
Exactly.
<please.">
Yeah. Get back to it next semester or yeah. maybe never.
Yeah. Were any of your ancestors also players?
No, I think my dad played a little like just for fun, like on the pond kind of thing, and you know, all my cousins play, so we still as a family, and actually the beverage company Breakthrough Beverage has a hockey tournament every year where we have like, it started sort of as a pickup game and it's turned into this thing where we've got, you know, liquor sales people from, you know, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Florida, all fly into Chicago, and we have this tournament. So all my cousins all play. So cool. As a family,
you're
we play
playing in it?
And I play in that. I play goalie, and it is a little bit like Boston, the dunk tank kind of thing. Because like I only play once a year, and it's here. Literally like I get in net and you can just fire away in my head, whatever you want.
No pads.
It's painful. Yeah. So, you know, as a family, we still like to play, and we try to incorporate it into our companies as well.
Let's talk Breakthrough Beverage while. Mm-hmm. So how does this company come about, and how is it serving? I mean, I would imagine a lot of the people who've been on the podcast are clients.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So how does that, how does it work from a distribution standpoint?
Totally.
And what's the history of that company?
So anybody who works in the bar trade, you know, knows this world, but I think for most people, it's a fairly obscure aspect of the industry as to how the distribution tier works. And so if I could just do a quick little overview of that, yeah, I think that might
Danny
be helpful.
Danny knows. This Danny knows.
Yeah.
That
so, Danny knows too. The U.S. Liquor business is based on a three-tier system, which has very defined roles and licenses for the manufacturers. So think of Diageo, Brown-Forman, Beam, Pernod Ricard, all the folks that own the brands. There's a middle tier, which is folks like us, Breakthrough Beverage. And then there's the retailers like Danny and any other licensed retailer or operator, you know, bar, restaurant, etc. And each one of those tiers has to be distinctly licensed and cannot operate in each other's tier for the most part. There's plenty of loopholes, which you don't need to go into. But so customers have to buy from wholesalers and manufacturers has to sell to a wholesaler as well. So we sit in the middle of the system. So we have essentially two sets of clients. We have to make sure the manufacturers are happy. So we're often exclusive with different manufacturers by market. So in the state of Illinois, Breakthrough Beverage represents Diageo, Gallo, Brown-Forman, you know, Remy Cointreau, William Grant & Sons. So all the brands that are in those portfolios. And then when bars, restaurants, retailers want to buy them, they buy them from us. So we have, I think, just under 1,000 employees in the state of Illinois. If you think about, you know, sort of your typical sales and operations, you know, we have to cover every inch of the state. So if you have a liquor license and you have a tiny tavern in the rural Illinois, we're delivering to you, we're servicing you. If you're in River North in a high volume hotel, or if you're Binny's or Costco, we're also rolling trucks and salespeople in there too. So we tend to be a fairly extensive network of people in markets that are representing alcohol beverage in many ways. And, you know, we think there's a lot of value there, where we feel really good about, you know, partnerships, and we can sort of become in a lot of people in this direct to consumer world see this sort of like tier as this like inhibitor of growth. But if you go to other countries where this doesn't exist, you actually see, you know, your top three manufacturers control most of the market. Mm-hmm. So, and as frustrating as there's aspects of the system are for some folks in the industry, you know, I challenge anyone to go to Binny's and tell me that the consumer in Chicago doesn't have more choice than ever before.
Overwhelming.
It's a lot. It's almost too much. But that's a reflection of then the market then decides, you know, what brands should be viable versus it being the system itself. So
old is the company, Breakthrough?
It originally was Wirtz Beverage, and then actually before that was a company called Judge & Dolph, for all the old school industry folks. And we bought that company, I think, in like 1947. It was like, you know, medicinal I think we bought it from Walgreens or something like that.
Wow.
So it's been in our family for a long time. So then you think about like my dad and grandfather and the folks in the industry that they've interacted with, you know, think of the restaurant operators, think about some of the retailers.
Yeah.
They're on multiple generations in some cases, which is really cool because you really do become kind of embedded in this industry because we've been rolling trucks into some of these buildings, you know, for those four generations.
That's wild.
It's pretty cool. So
how did they get into it? How'd they make the decision to,
it wasn't for any kind of like strategic reason like you would today. I think it was kind of a high cash flow business. I think there was probably some like tax offsetting with some other businesses at the time. Our first business was in Milwaukee in Wisconsin. And then Illinois followed after that. So, you know, and then over time it was kind of a wild west. It was, everyone sold everything. So it wasn't exclusive brands. You only had small territories of the state. You weren't statewide. So like any other industry, it was, you know, there was probably dozens of wholesalers and it's been consolidated down to a handful of large ones. And then, you know, I still think a very vibrant secondary, especially in wine, specialty wholesalers and distributors out there.
Yeah, I was going to say what trends are emerging right now. We talk about it a lot, like bourbon had a moment, is still having a moment, obviously, agave-based spirits recently, natural wines. What kinds of things are you seeing on the distributor end?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, gosh, the tequila and agave world is it does seem to be limitless. There's sort of like two trends happening: premiumization, but also a little bit more of a retrenching right now too. So you sort of have two kind of worlds where it seems like price is going up in some cases, but in some cases there's some real, you know, consumer temperance around what they're spending on alcohol beverage. Clearly, you know, good Lord, everything is in a can now. Every ready to drink mix type thing. And it's actually, it's really diversified, you know, from sort of malt based beverages to spirit based cocktails to now sort of more functional CBD, cannabis, Delta 9. I mean, it just seems like we are proliferating the amount of products that are available to consumers. Mm-hmm. So I think this is sort of, in one sense, a really exciting time because there's just so much choice out there. But it's also like anytime you give that much choice to the market, eventually, you know, certain things will succeed and certain things, you know, won't. So I think we're kind of in an interesting time right now watching a lot of new concepts come to market, and we'll see what kind of sticks around. But
what do you think? This is kind of a question for both of you guys. What do you think contributes to the diversification of, like, there are a million options now? Is it just a low barrier to entry? Is it sexy to have a CPG? Why are there so many options?
Well, I have to say, unfortunately, you know, I was telling someone earlier, like Tito Beverage, who started Tito's, and George Clooney and Randy Gerber from Casamigos sort of created this monster in that they made it look so easy, meaning that they've been wildly successful and they worked really hard to build those brands that they did. And anyone who's looking on, who's not familiar with how it works, makes it look like, well, if I have a great idea.
Yeah, I should be able to succeed. I actually was just about to ask about that. Is, you know, earlier you talked about brand building. What are some of the brand strategies that you employ to build up a brand?
It's such a combination of so many different things have to be right. You know, clearly you start with a product. Like, the product has to be good. It has to taste good. It has to have good quality. The packaging has to be right. That's sort of table stakes. And in this day and age, very rarely do you see something that sort of misses on that. Like, you can acquire either really good spirits or you can create products at pretty decent qualities at this point. But then, like anything, it's the people behind them, right? Do they have the will to succeed? Do they have the capital to succeed? Do they have the smarts and knowledge and expertise to go to market? That's on the manufacturing side. Then we come into play. Like, you know, you have to be able to get to market and you have to have realistic expectations about how you want to grow. If you see Tito and think that he just got into every shelf and every bar overnight, then you're probably going to be misaligned with your expectations, because that was like a 10-year overnight success. Mm-hmm. So I think so. It's like fundamentals are still so basic, but that's kind of where a lot of brands fall. Like, it's like, and it's not necessarily about just go get the influencer and then everything works out. It's like all those kind of like unsexy things: getting your production right, getting your costing right, getting your price and positioning right. Again, none of this sounds really fun, and it's not what people think of when they want to get into this industry, but it's the thing that probably keeps the successes and failures, you know, from happening. So I always think it's just, you know, sticking to those fundamentals. And then in this day and age, especially with all this, you know, proliferation, you have to have some differentiation. You have to have something different that someone else isn't offering.
Yeah.
Because if it's just, we have a better this category or that, subjective, it's just not enough. You know, it's just not enough. It has to have another hook. And so hopefully that hook has something with some staying power, has a real story and authenticity. And I think that's authenticity is also a bigger piece than ever. You know, back in the 90s, no one really cared about where things were from or what kind of ingredients were in things, but we're in such a more transparent world now. You know, people really do care about who's behind that brand. How is it made? Is it done ethically, responsibly, all those kinds of things? And so all those ingredients have to come together, a little bit of luck and then a little bit of momentum.
Yeah.
And even that doesn't even guarantee success.
It's funny. I just real quick have a funny story from the other night. I'm not going to mention the brand, but
we'll guess it.
But just realizing how little I really understand about the mechanics of brand building, because I went to this thing. It didn't really seem to make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a bunch of us there. They'd clearly spent a lot of money. And I came away from it being like, huh, I wonder what this really does for this brand, why they spent this money. Meanwhile, I've told this story like 10 times since I went to this thing. And I'm like, oh, perhaps like I'm the moron here. Like it clearly worked. I've mentioned this brand so many times since. And it's just
you're
like,
not going to give them any love right now.
No, I mean, no, because I insult, like I'm kind of insulting.
No, but I want, like, you know, in a perfect world, Danny, are you telling it because record, it was this outrageous event that they spent a lot of money on? Or were you impressed by the product quality?
Did you have a good time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I had a great time. I think I already knew the product was of a high quality. I was more just trying to wrap my mind around like why they pulled out all the stops and why they spent all this money and why they spent the money in the ways that they did.
Perhaps it was your imposter syndrome
and just ruminating on it and then thinking like, ah, now I'm getting it. Like those types of events like do have an effect, and maybe it's hard to quantify and hard to measure, but perhaps like enough of those things are happening in these brands that it gets them
for sure.
That.
And you asked sort of what are the brand building things? I mean, one of the tried and trues of the industry is that unlike other CPG, the bar trade is an incredible, like what other industry has a place where people can go and try something and experience something before they buy it at retail? There's no like toothpaste bars or I guess there were cereal.
That's interesting.
There were cereal bars, but this is.
Yeah, what happened to cereality?
Yeah,
remember
I know.
That place?
Yeah, totally. But if you think about it, like, so you can see why the sort of the formula tends to work where, you know, and they spend a lot of time and money and effort to make your bar a place where someone could experience that brand. And that I think will be a tried and true for a long time. Now, the question is, you know, it's not your job to build the brand. And I think sometimes that expectation gets a little mixed, but I think maybe in partnership, if there's something you truly love and you think your customers will love, you can really find some nice partnerships where I think bars, restaurants, hotels can be part of a brand success. And I'm sure all the great brands can talk about some of those early customers that brought their brand to life. And I know they appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure.
Danny, you have a differentiator, Osmanthus Blossom. That's true. Wouldn't you say? Can you name another old Tom gin like that?
Differentiators and gin are good because you can work with a lot of botanicals.
Yeah, for sure. I think what's interesting for us, like that brand's been around, you know, since 2013, and we were like the third old Tom gin in the market as far as we knew. It was like Heyman's, Ransom, and then us. Mm-hmm. But it's like, yeah, the amount of effort and energy we'd have to spend to make it like a real, you know, big brand, I feel like it's just so overwhelming. And I feel like people probably who are listening who think they can start a brand, it was good that you touched on the Casamigos story and Tito's because there really is so much to it. It's a lot of luck. It's a lot of timing. It's a lot of energy. It's a lot of resources.
As far as I can tell, it's not like the Tito's formula works. Like it only works for Tito's. Yeah. It was a moment in time.
Yeah, it was unique.
Lightning strikes once for him. You don't just take that playbook and then just give it to someone and say, okay, do that in gin or do that in bourbon. It's like, you know, every one of these stories tends to have its unique moment to be successful. And the cool thing about the industry is that, you know, behind most brands is a really interesting story of a founder, of a creator, and of a production that's kind of fun, is whether that's something really handcrafted or something that actually is just a really great marketing idea that works.
Are brands seeking you out or are you seeking out brands? I know there's like big guys and there's little guys who like could really benefit from more distribution or awareness. How do you balance that?
The larger manufacturers, you know, we are always courting their business or trying to retain the business that we have. For the smaller up and coming and emerging brands, they're the ones that are sort of knocking on our door looking for distribution. I would say that part of the business has grown tremendously. I mean, it used to be a brand here and there, and now it's, you know, daily there are tens, hundreds, thousands across the year. We've also put more science against it because it kind of was like, you know, can I get into your office and try this, you know, brand? And if you like it, we'll take you and distribute, like very gut feel kind of thing.
Shark Tank.
Yeah, it's very Shark Tank. Now our Shark Tank has some kind of rubric and formula, and we've got a team that does that proper valuation because it's a risk on both ends. It's a partnership. It's a real business relationship. You want to make sure you do right by. So our philosophy is often sort of, you know, we want to have all the hard conversations up front. So if you actually are in distribution with us, we're not just taking you on a flyer and just hope it works, because that's your That's your life. That's your sometimes your savings. Mm-hmm. We don't want to just throw it at the wall and hope it sticks. We want to, if we believe in it, we want to be your partner and then grow your brand.
What's a brand that you've taken on that you know has succeeded beyond both sides, like wildest dreams?
I mean,
I'm sure, yeah, there's tons.
I'll give you like a non-mixology one that just as a fascinating, and it's a top 10 brand for us in Illinois in particular. Are you familiar with Monaco? It's a ready-to-drink vodka in a can.
Does it have a triangle on it?
So this is a brand that started as a ready-to-drink vodka energy drink, targeting clubs. Everything was wrong. Like, it was energy, which was at the time very controversial.
I bet I know the era.
It was nightclubs, which if you start by spending money in nightclubs to build your brand, you're going to blow your money. But the creators went back to the drawing board, and they knew they kind of understood formulation and brand, and they just went out to the market and talked to people what they want. They put it in a can. It's I think it's two shots for $5 a can. So the proposition is very easy. This is not like very sophisticated marketing. And specifically, I think they focused in the Latino community, and they focused on some flavors that had some resonance there. And it might be a top five brand in the state of Illinois for us right now. So Illinois in particular index is really high. So I only say that to say it isn't always the rocket scientist type ideas, right? It's also very back to basics. What do people want? And can you fill a market void that people are interested in? So it's been cool to see something like that sort of emerge on top of, you know, the other things that are a longer hand sell over time. It's been amazing to see brands have resurgences.
Yeah,
so you think of a brand like Old Forester that is like the original bourbon, you know, is having a renaissance, but it's been around forever, right? Yeah. So every store, every brand has a different story, a different path. And I just think it's a fun industry to be part of and be, you know, a facilitator of some of these successes.
Yeah.
On the topic of like outside of those subjective things, you know, differentiator, the team behind a brand, what are the numbers that you're looking at? Like as far as statistics and I was going to ask about statistics in sports too, but like
so,
when you're analyzing a company to bring on.
Well, to bring on, I mean, it's because there's no base of business. It's sort of like, what are their expectations? They want to be in the top 30 accounts in Chicago. Do they want to be in like 1,000 accounts? Like that expectation right off the bat is a big thing. One of the biggest indicators, I think, is reorder. So a distributor, I mean, if we really want to, we can muscle stuff into the trade pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And maybe Danny, your bar has a few of those examples.
Yeah, I've been muscled.
But, you know, and look, if you own a brand, you're like, oh my gosh, look at how much we sold. Look at how many accounts we're in.
Yeah.
Don't celebrate too quickly. Let's take a look in a few months from now, how many reordered.
Yeah.
And if that number's low, that's a problem. If it's good, we're now seeing true traction. Someone's pulling it through. A bar decided to actually pour that brand, or the retailer is actually promoting it and it's going through. So the concept of reorder is a really important piece, as opposed to just sort of pushing it and sort of hoping that, you know, something happens. Because the first sale in many cases is sort of the easiest. It's getting someone to buy something the second time.
Yeah. Customer acquisition.
Yeah.
And then on the sports side,
yeah,
what metrics are you paying attention to?
Oh, gosh. I think the metrics now have far surpassed my ability to even understand.
Do you have a number cruncher on staff?
So on the hockey side, you know, we went from, I think, at the bottom of the league in terms of analytical resources to now the top. Wow. We've got a brain trust of folks that are crunching so many numbers and building out kind of our internal system. So for the upcoming draft, we're looking across so many different metrics and then blending them together and looking them in aggregate, you know, it's kind of scoring and sort of quadrant placing in terms of where players are not only performing, but where they're expected to perform. So, so I think that's been a really cool thing to watch emerge, and that we not only have that, but the people who make the decisions on the hockey side are trusting of that data, are in part because you hear the classic kind of like the old school folks and the number crunchers aren't getting along. Luckily, we've built a really cool culture where I think both are validated, that, you know, we can trust the numbers, but we also trust the eye test of our scouts and the capabilities of our, you know, scouting team.
Just picturing Jonah Hill in there. Just,
yeah, exactly.
Did he get an Oscar for that?
Nomination, maybe? I think, yeah.
I had a question about when the Hawks were on a roll and winning Stanley Cups. I think it was 10, 13, 15. Yep. I remember where I was when they won and where I celebrated. I was standing in the road at Six Corners in Wicker Park, double fisting PBRs.
Yeah.
Cops were letting us do it.
Is this every time or just one of those?
I think all three, actually. I lived over
same place, same
Street,
beers.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Same cops. But I was wondering, how do you celebrate and what does the team do? Like after they're off screen, what does that look like?
So each of the cups was very different. The first two were in the away arena.
Different.
Then the third one was at home. And I'll share a little bit about the distinct difference. I think the first one was, I was in the state of shock. I don't even know if I was ready to fully celebrate because it just was the most incredible. I can't believe that just happened, and it was very emotional. The second one, I actually like let my hair down. I was like, okay, yeah, we just won the Stanley Cup in 17 seconds. Everything changed. You remember that was against Boston.
Yeah.
And those celebrations are in the locker room. It's everything you probably seen online. You know, it is a showering of both champagne and Bud Light, which is a terrible combination both for consuming and to have yourself covered in.
Aromatically.
Yeah, it smells terrible.
It's an olfactory nightmare.
So, I mean, that's it. I mean, that is sort of that's the celebration. And, you know, unlike other sports, which I'm always amazed when they sort of are champagne spraying before they've won the championship, doesn't feel right. In hockey, there's none of that until you actually win the cup and you're the last team standing. The one we won in 15 was at home. And I think this has been written about, so it's not news, but we were already planning on renovating the locker rooms. And of course, the players knew that. So there was a combination of not only the champagne, the beer, everything, you know, flowing. But everyone knew that the room was going to be redone anyway, so there was like a snowing of the ceiling breaking apart as people were just like punching the ceiling, and I don't know, the combination of the pulp from the ceiling mixed with all these other liquids created this pretty nasty setup. But you know, you just won the Stanley Cup, so everything's great.
Got the Beastie Boys treatment.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, everything that's been reported of, you know, the cup becomes then this thing that sort of the party goes around town, and maybe you saw it, you know, during those years where the players would take it in and out of bars and clubs and restaurants.
Seen a lot of imitators, some made of like duct tape.
Yeah, then everybody has their own. Yeah, exactly. But the cool thing is for a major trophy like that, you know, it's very accessible, especially with our players who did take it to the people right there.
Yeah, I feel like it went to DeVille at some point.
That was my night. And that was really fun.
That was cool.
I had a couple hours where I could kind of navigate where it went. I think we took it to Piccolo Sogno and saw Tony, and then we brought it over to DeVille, which was really cool. And I could only give maybe a heads up within an hour, like, because if it was two...
Was it Brad and Ronnie and Eric there, or who was there?
Yeah, the whole gang, mm-hmm. and Matt. It was special. So it wasn't overcrowded, kind of, if you just happened to be there.
Wow.
You saw the cup, you got a picture with it, and then, you know, social media eventually.
It's not pre-announced. Like, it's if you run into the cup, it's by accident.
It is.
Is everyone drinking out of this cup?
So there's some rules around drinking out of it, hoisting it. You have to, I think you have to be a player technically to drink
post-COVID,
out of it.
It's probably.
Oh yeah, I don't know what the rules are for that now. But I think like if a player hands you the cup and you can drink out of it, but there's always the handler with the cup who has all these rules. So
you had the handler with you?
Yes, he was with us. We have a car and just kind of bounced around.
I assume you count higher than a player, so if you hand it to me, I can drink from
it. You know,
you wouldn't be able to lift it, Danny.
I don't know. I little tiny muscles? I was very, like...
Break both my arms.
I was very deferential to the Stanley Cup handlers. I didn't want to
Is that a full-time job?
Yeah. They work for the Hall of Fame.
Cool.
And there's, I think, at least two or three... folks that have seen it all, and you know, we'll write the book one day about.
Wow, what are we doing bringing you on here? We should have brought the handler.
Oh yeah, that's.
They've probably got some good stories.
So when next time we win the Stanley Cup, we'll bring the handler in.
It's coming.
The cup comes to the Joiner studio. Yeah. It's just Tim and I in here.
I had one more question before we get to the gratuity round. We don't want to keep you too long. Are the team owners in Chicago? Do you get together with the other owners? Is there a larger
secret society?
Basically, yeah.
Illuminati.
Is that what that ring is? Ring? But is there like a board where you guys work together for, you know, maybe Cubs and Sox sit on opposite sides, but do you guys get together and is there communication?
I think
like
informally, for
Chicago
sure.
Sports as a whole?
There is. And whether it's through some philanthropic things we work on together, I think there's sort of like a best practice kind of forum often, in again, mostly informally, you know, maybe a dinner once a year. And we're just, you know, we're always rooting on it. I mean, there's a level of competition, obviously, but I think generally speaking, we all like to see Chicago do well. And obviously, our partners in the building at the United Center with the Bulls, you know, we're rooting them on. We're rooting them on tonight. I don't know when this will air, but maybe we'll be in the playoffs. Who knows? But we're all good pals.
Sorry to bring a little bit of a somber tone for a second, but you know, last year you became the patriarch of the Wirtz family. Mm-hmm. What has that transition been like, both like on a personal level and on a business level?
Yeah, it's been difficult and hard, not in a functional sense, like I don't know how to do this job, but just not having my dad, who, yeah, you know, was an amazing mentor and coach and partner. He was really good about, you know, from when I moved back here almost 17 years ago now, you know, he let me be part of all the businesses. He exposed me to all of them in different forms and fashions. So, you know, he was always preparing me for what this job would be. So I always felt, I feel very prepared. And now it's just, as I've said, told a few people, it's just not as fun without him. So I have to figure out, you know, where we go from here, try to find our own fun, try to find, you know, the new opportunities we can explore as a family business, and all the good things that we can do for the city of Chicago. So
do you want your kids to be involved as well when they grow up?
If they want. I think the sort of days of mandating, you know, that are over. My dad was great because, he let me go on tour with Ministry after college. Like, he was so supportive of me going off, you know, into a completely different industry, live in New York, all this kind of stuff. And it was almost like he knew, like, if I just do that, I'll get him back one day. And sure enough.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that, I think.
Sure enough, you know, the circumstances worked themselves out to where I was ready to come home. He had a job that he was looking to hire within Wirtz Beverage at the time. And lo and behold, we started working together. And so, you know, I think just letting kids be who they are, follow their passions, and, you know, hopefully they have their own drive to come and contribute that to the business in whatever form that is.
This episode is brought to you by Scofflaw Old Tom Gin, a tasty, versatile spirit. Created in Chicago in 2012, the product was born out of a need for a bespoke iteration of the Old Tom style, which is the slightly sweeter predecessor to London Dry. Scofflaw Old Tom Gin carries classic notes of orange peel, juniper, and coriander, while balancing on a subtle floral edge thanks to the addition of osmanthus blossoms. Its elevated proof is suitable in cocktails or unadorned. Scofflaw Old Tom Gin. Complete your bar.
All right, Tim,
are you ready for the gratuity round?
Yes.
He looks very nervous. All right.
Possible answers, but we'll take it.
We're starting easy. What's your death row meal?
So I was thinking about this. You know, my favorite meal, not just because it tastes delicious, is probably what it represents, is my wife's like roasted chicken.
Okay.
Which when I was sharing this concept with her, she's like, well, yeah, just make sure you specify that it's Ina Garden's recipe. It's not her recipe. So yeah. So it's her roasted chicken with roasted vegetables and potatoes, and it's always like, you know, like the most warming and comforting thing. And, you know, hopefully the family's all gathered around to eat it together. So that's the best part about it.
Is that a special occasion meal, or is that you're getting that?
It's kind of usually winter because the oven's on, yeah, and just smells good, and it's like, oh, I'm home. Especially, you know, living a busy life or a hectic work day, it's kind of like a nice comforting thing to come home to. And so yeah, that would be that. And then I'd have to finish it with I love key lime pie. Key lime pie is like my jam. So
favorite one in the city.
So I would say typically it's like a Joe's stone crab. And
good answer. It's the same at Shaw's.
Oh, right? okay, that's good to know. But I have to give a little plug too for like a newer version. I love the hibiscus one from Spinning Jays.
Oh, Spinning Jays is great.
But hibiscus, not if you're pregnant, don't have hibiscus. But I think that's a really good one locally.
Dino will love that shout out.
Yeah. All right. I have high hopes for this one. What's your favorite hidden gem restaurant?
So I feel like hidden gem, this may not be hidden or obscure, but I love it. And we're going there tonight for dinner. But Senatore on California.
Nice.
Oh, I know.
Nice.
Maybe you would consider that off the beaten path because it's on California and Augusta. But I just think they're doing a great thing over there. And that space has always been a great kind of neighborhood spot.
Yep.
But just really into what they do. And I'm excited to go there.
Favorite fast food?
So I'm not a huge fast food fan.
Boom.
I know. I'm like, I know.
We've gotten that snobby, a lot from a lot
right?
of people.
No. But I will say, like, I was trying to think, like, what's the one thing you can only get in the fast food version that doesn't, like, scale up well?
Mm.
I think it's a Chicago hot dog.
Yeah.
And I actually don't have, like, a preference of the stand. Clearly, like, a Vienna beef stand and just a pure classic Chicago style with all the stuff. That would be my go-to.
I'll accept it.
Yeah.
All right. What's your favorite Chicago team other than the Blackhawks? Which one do you follow most closely?
I'm sort of an equal fan of everyone. I'm very diplomatic and, you know.
diplomatic. Well, you're a Northsider.
Yeah. So I grew up on the Cubs.
Yeah.
So I can't deny that. And sort of like the sort of Andre Dawson, Jody Davis,
yeah.
Rick Sutcliffe days. But of course, I'm very loyal to our partners, the Reinsdorf. So, so I'm giving you a terrible answer. I mean, I gotta say the Bulls. I mean, the Bulls, you know, especially.
They're your roommates.
We're roommates. We want to see them do well. We want the building to be rocking again. And obviously, living through the Jordan era, you know, that gets imprinted in you. So, go Bulls.
It does. Even Danny, right? You're a Bulls fan in the 90s.
100%.
Gotta be. All right. Favorite United Center meal right now?
I think, and not just selfishly, because I feel like I was very much an advocate of it to create it, but Queenie's, I think, is
it's solid.
It's coming into its own, and it's hard to do. Those that know kind of, you know, that level of food, you know, it's one thing to create it once, but to do it where there's essentially one turn, one seating, and everybody's eating at the same time to get out to the game is very challenging.
Yeah, it's a sprint.
And then finding that right ratio between timing and quality. And I think right now they are just firing all cylinders. Like, their fish specials are like, you know, they're not just like good for a stadium meal. They're like, you know, Chicago restaurant quality, which is great. So I'm really proud of what they've been able to do.
Nice. Outside of the owner's box, what's the best seat for a Hawks game?
I actually like being up a little higher. So I would say maybe like, you know, red line lower 300 level or the 200 level. 200 level is pretty cool because there's a coat check. It's a little bougie.
Yeah,
and kind of you
it's
get
fancy.
It's a little fancier, but up a little higher. Yeah.
Yeah. Get a good view. What's your least favorite food?
So this, I get ridicule all the time for this because I feel like maybe the only I don't like macaroni and cheese. I don't like creamy, like, and like, ugh.
Consider that a challenge for the restaurateurs and chefs listening.
Yeah, totally.
Can you create?
Yeah.
And he just has to like a Wordsworth a million bowls of mac and cheese over the next year each time.
I mean, like, I don't know that I'm a huge mac and cheese guy.
I mean, I like it. I like Smokes the best, probably.
Yeah, I do always get it at Smoke. That's true.
I think
yeah.
maybe I just don't like a lot of like creamy, cheesy sauces.
Yeah,
so
you don't like
it's not
an
a
Alfredo,
feel good. You don't
probably.
Feel good
no,
afterwards.
No, exactly.
No Alfredo, no garlic cream stuff.
Bechamel or anything like that.
Okay, cool.
No.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Favorite cocktail?
Okay. This is kind of like the music question where it's like, there's no easy answer. I'm an overthinker and situational of everything, every decision I make as it relates to beverages. So I'll do it seasonally. Cold months, probably Manhattan.
A rye or bourbon Manhattan?
Rye, but all cool with bourbon too. A Negroni would be kind of transitional seasonal. Mm-hmm.
Is this rocks or up?
I'd say rocks.
Cool. With
as long as the spirits are good. Yeah, all good. And then summer, I mean, a classic margarita, just tried and true, fresh, delicious.
Tequila one or a mezcal one?
I've had more mezcal of recent, but equal opportunity.
An either important cool. distinction.
And when the Pappy allocations come in, do you squirrel away a few bottles for your house or you leave
them
at work?
I do. Not to squirrel away and hoard. If you come to my house,
no, you drink
please,
it.
Please have some. Please have it. I don't believe in
do you
hoarding.
Have a favorite thing. of the lineup?
Like, I kind of like the younger ones.
Yeah,
to be honest
like,
with you.
Yeah, I like 10, 13, 15.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, 13 is my number one.
Yeah,
the rye. But yeah,
it's delicious stuff, and it's done.
Yeah, to call in some favors.
Yeah.
All right, here's our cameo question. This one comes from my wife's uncle, Matt Burke. He's a men's league hockey champion in Evergreen Park.
Amazing.
He says, I believe they have the second pick in the draft this year. I'm wondering, are you looking for a forward to support Bedard or defense?
Both would be good. I don't think we have a direction. Well, to be clear, at this point today of taping, there's still the lottery, to which we are currently in the second position, with the second best odds to go get number one again. Mm-hmm. And then obviously we have different leveling odds we could drop down to four. That being said, there's both defensemen and forwards this draft that are really appealing. So, you know, forwards would give us some great depth around Connor in the first two lines, we think. And then defense, you know, we've got already a pretty good defensive prospects, but this would like put us over the edge. So kind of good either way.
He also had a tip. I said Anton Salaev. I guess he's a 6'7"
big defenseman. Kid.
Yeah.
Big Russian.
So, yeah. Maybe keep it in mind.
Yeah. No, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a super fan. He's got four girls, and the youngest girl's like a phenomenal hockey player.
Amazing. Yeah. Very cool.
All right. Favorite band or musician? Are we going Ministry?
Well, I mean, yes. That's probably like sort of from a, like, that's like family, right? But I don't know that I could pick a favorite, you know.
You do have a team song.
Yes, exactly. They did a team song.
And I think I know all the words to it.
Yeah, Keys to the City, which was done not beloved by our previous team president, but which I don't think I appreciated at the time, but I realized why I never played it. But music for me is really, really big, sort of soundtrack of my life. So depending on, you know, the time of my life, I was into certain music. I probably have sort of danced with every genre. You know, I'm not a big country fan. I'm not a big jam band fan, but pretty much everything else, I've had a phase, and probably the hairstyle or looks to match.
So. We're ready for the throwback photos.
I'm gonna do some work this weekend to sort of dig in the archives and see if I could find some of the Ministry tour photos, which there weren't many. This was analog photo days. There was definitely rave style. There was some like punk ska looks that were, I mean, it's, yeah.
I'm looking
Thank God
to that.
Digital photography didn't exist in the late 90s, early 2000s.
All right. Favorite movie?
Slapshot. I mean, sort of probably to expect, but I mean, I just think it's, well, in some ways it's maybe not aging well, but in other ways it's just,
that's a classic.
Beautiful.
I owe Danny $20. I thought it was Mighty Ducks. Or sorry, I thought D3.
Oh, so the Mighty Ducks kind of that, like all the kids of the 90s, like when they were born in the early
90s. Yeah, I'm
like,
a Mighty Ducks fan.
That was a very important
was my time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it turned into a team.
Totally. Yeah. And then, of course, the, you know, Youngblood was another good 80s hockey movie with Rob Lowe. Highly recommend.
I need to see that.
Yeah, a little more, gritty.
All right, and here's our last question. If you weren't doing this, all of the things that you're doing, what would you be doing?
Yeah, probably something in music or hospitality, to be honest with you. Probably something low-key.
Yeah.
Probably something, you know, managing band, running an independent record label, owning a shop, you know, probably something off the beaten path a little bit.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a wrap on Danny Wirtz. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being
good
here.
Good being with y'all.
And that concludes our conversation with Danny Wirtz of the Blackhawks and the Wirtz family.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
The Danny Wirtz.
The Danny.
Yeah.
Dare I go there?
Oh, my gosh.
Danny.
Now I'm Danny,
I'm
too.
Sorry, man.
I've now become the second biggest Danny on the podcast.
What have I done?
Oh, brutal.
It was bound to happen.
All right. Time for Arthur to take over.
Arthur, you're getting called up to the big leagues. Grab your mic. That is a good idea. You should get him started on stuff like that. Maybe get him like a karaoke machine.
We have
like a familiar with
Fisher Price, my first podcasting kit.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Not Fisher Price. I mean, we got to market that ourselves. Joiner's brand. Joiner's brand. My first podcast kit. for the little narcissist in your family.
Exactly, for kids who love to hear their own voices.
Yeah, speaking of narcissism, check us out on social media. We have photos of our guests. We've got cocktail recipes, even reels that tease the episodes.
Ooh, yeah.
And drop a review. You know, we won't stop asking for those.
Yep.
We haven't
rectified. You're the person who left that one-star review.
We're still thinking about
you. Please revise.
Please reach out to us. please reach out to Danny, who lives near Humboldt Park, which is as much as he's willing. I do wonder about your... is it because you're afraid your employees are going to come to your house and tickle you or something? What's the deal? Yeah,
tickle fight.
Yeah. I mean, how many times have I said I live in the West Loop?
I've had a lot of stalkers in my life. I don't know.
Have you actually had a stalker?
I mean, a few, yeah.
I have too, actually. Well, maybe we'll talk about it offline.
It would be funny if we had the same stalkers.
Well, I married mine.
that's the way to do it. Genius.
All right. This episode is produced by Matt Haddock, music by Captain Cuts, and you know our real work's done by the one and only Joe Guza III. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. You're a Blackhawk, you stay with pride. So many legends have played for our side. Kita Hull, Esposito, Sipar.